So this paper I'm going to present was written for a forthcoming volume on Quine, meant to be accessible to advanced undergraduates and so forth. And I was asked to write about Quine's conception of explication, and I have written on that before, but now I thought I would take the chance to give a sort of wider picture of what place it has within his view of philosophy, and also look at its roots in Carnap's philosophy. And the more I started reading Carnap carefully and Quine, I realized that they actually are working with quite different conceptions of explication, and the differences mirror fundamental differences in their wider philosophical outlook. But this is also part of a wider project I have. I have a kind of book project in mind, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. But anyway, I think I've been interested in what I want to call a revisionist strand in the analytic philosophical tradition, where thinkers in that part of the tradition has the view that the task of philosophy is not to expose hidden meanings, as the term analytic would suggest, but rather to replace defective concepts by new superior concepts. It is arguable that Frege has certain revisionist features, I think, but I think Carnap and Quine are definitely two very the two most prominent revisionists, perhaps. Wilfrid Sellers is an interesting case. Richard Rorty is an interesting case. I think this idea of a revisionist strand makes it possible to see Rorty as very much within the analytic tradition of philosophy, actually. I think the quotation number one on the handout from Quine gives a very clear statement of sort of generally revisionist attitude. We don't claim synonymy. We don't claim to make clear and explicit what the users of the unclear expression had unconsciously in mind all along. We don't expose hidden meanings, as the words analysis and explication would suggest. We supply lacks. We fix on the particular functions of the unclear expression that make it worth troubling about, and then devise a substitute, clear and couched in terms of our own liking, that fills those functions. Beyond those conditions of partial agreement dictated by our interests and purposes, any traits of the explicants comes under the head of don't cares. And it will be an interesting matter of difference between different revisionists, that they will have quite different ideas about what the relevant purposes are. So in Quine and Carnap, you have the purposes of science, on a certain understanding of what science is, as the most important purposes, I think, whereas in Rorty, you have quite different ideas about what purposes philosophy should strive to fulfill, of course. Now, if you just look at quotations like this one and then certain other quotations from Carnap, it will appear as if Quine's and Carnap's conceptions are quite similar, like the quotation two, which is from Carnap's The Logical Foundations of Probability, which is the book where he gives the most extensive account of his conception of explication. He says, the task of explication consists in transforming a given more or less inexact concept into an exact one, or rather in replacing the first by the second. Blah, blah, blah. The explicandum, that is the given concept, may belong to everyday language or to a previous stage in the development of scientific language. The explicatum, the replacement, must be given by explicit rules for its use, for example, by definition which incorporates it into a well-constructed system of scientific, either logical, mathematical, or empirical concepts. And if you look at quotation 18 on the handout, you see a similarly pragmatic strand in Carnap's conception. Since the datum, the explicandum, is inexact, the problem itself is not stated in exact terms, and yet we are asked to give an exact solution. This is one of the puzzling peculiarities of explication. It follows that if a solution for a problem of explication is proposed, we cannot decide in an exact way whether it is right or wrong. Strictly speaking, the question whether the solution is right or wrong makes no good sense because there is no clear-cut answer. The question should rather be whether the proposed solution is satisfactory, whether it is more satisfactory than another one, and the like. Okay, but when you start to look closer at it, it becomes more complicated. We can't really equate Carnapian explication with Quinean explication, even if Quine himself actually suggests that we can. And several other commentators have argued that we can, but I'm going to argue that we can. So we have Carnapian explication. But when you look at Quine's writing, you actually have several varieties of revision that fits more or less good with Carnapian explication. So you have Quinean regimentation, I'm sort of assuming that you have read the paper at least a little, but anyway, I'll go through this. We have Quinean regimentation, and Quinean regimentation is a matter of fitting language into what Quine calls canonical notation. So it's a matter of fitting language into first order predicate logic with identity. Okay. That's one thing for Quine. That's one form of revision that's very important to Quine. Okay. Another form of revision which is very important to Quine is, we can call it paraphrasing away. And that's a matter of when you have terms that appear to refer to something, Quine argues that in some cases you can simply paraphrase them, and the paraphrase will contain no referential term that needs to be accounted for, so to speak, by finding a substitute. So for example, what he says is that this is a case where a defective noun, as he says, proves undeserving of objects. It is dismissed as an irreferential fragment. So for example, if you take the term the average American family, okay? Then if you analyze that term, you will replace it by something that doesn't, you know, there is no such thing as the average American family in a referential sense. There is nothing to refer to there. There's nothing. So the paraphrase won't contain any referential term that refers to any object in the vicinity of this, you know, apparent object. But then you have explication. I can mention a few other examples of this sort of revision. For example, infinitesimals and geometrical points. Okay, terms where these things will, after Quine have treated on, will seem not to refer to anything at all, right? So they are just paraphrased the way they're. There is elimination in the very straightforward sense there. But explication is not like that. In explication, you devise a substitute that is still referential, right? So a defective noun, there you have a defective noun, it's defective in some sense that we will explore, but it's not as defective as here, because there's still a need for some kind of reference, right? So a case of explication would be Frege's account of numbers in terms of classes. So so the number one is not to be paraphrased away in this sense. There is still a reference for it. Okay. It's a certain class. Okay. Or in Quine's own favorite example, the notion of ordered pair, which is to be replaced by a certain class as well. But there is you're still working with, there is still a reference there to be found, so to speak. Okay. And there, Quine says explication is elimination. That's a slogan. But that slogan is kind of dangerous because it makes it easy to conflate explication with this form of paraphrasing. But as Quine is quite clear about, you can also think of explication in terms of identification. What we should say here is that, according to what Frege has shown, is that numbers is nothing but sets. Okay. So sets, and you can say that either by saying that there are no numbers, only sets. Or you can say that numbers are identical with sets. According to Quine, it doesn't matter what you say. It's just a, you know, matter of how you want to phrase it. It has a gentler ring, he says, to say that numbers are identical with sets, instead of saying that numbers don't exist. And another example of explication, according to Quine, is when mental states are identified with physical states. Or bodily states. Then you can say either there are no mental states, there are only bodily states, or you can say that mental states are nothing but bodily states, or mental states are identical with bodily states. According to Quine, it doesn't matter what you say, it's not a substantial difference. Well, anyway, so one question is how are they related to each other, really, in Quine, but then also how are they related to Carnap's explication? That's one big issue in this paper. Feel free to interrupt if you don't insist on it. Is it reasonably clear what? So, the first thing I do, I talk about Carnap, and I want to connect Carnap's conception of explication to his so-called principle of tolerance. And I argue together with several other commentators that the principle of tolerance is absolutely fundamental to Carnap's mature philosophy. It was first presented in 1934, of course, in Logische Syntax der Sprache. But I think it continues to play a very important role for Carnap, and I also think it's crucial to his conception of explication. And I think just the most famous formulation of his principle of tolerance is number 4 on your handout. In logic, there are no morals. Everyone is at liberty to build up his own logic, that is, his own form of language, as he wishes. All that is required of him is that if he wishes to discuss it, he must state his methods clearly and give syntactical rules instead of philosophical arguments. As many have pointed out, there is tolerance here is two-sided. On the one hand, there's a pluralism involved. On the other hand, what is required is that, you know, syntactical rules are given, it's a high standard of precision required for all these various logic. So what Carnap would not accept is a sort of language with no clear syntactical rules or something like that. So he's tolerant, but he's not tolerant towards imprecision or what he regards as imprecision. Okay, so to adopt the principle of tolerance is to abandon a traditional notion of the true and compulsory logical framework, replacing it by a pluralist attitude according to which there are many such frameworks to choose between. And according to Carnap, this choice is not to be made on some special philosophical grounds. Rather, and this is also another formulation of tolerance, the philosopher should grant to those who work in any special field of investigation any form of expression which seems useful to them, says Carnap. The work in the field will sooner or later lead to the elimination of those forms which have no useful function. So it's a sort of Darwinism with respect to vocabularies, but it's not up to the philosopher to decide which vocabulary or which logical framework is the best one. That will prove itself in the field of the actual scientific researcher, so to speak. So the philosopher's task is to invent and investigate the formal properties of various frameworks without deciding which one should be employed. This task is distinct from that of the scientist, even if the philosopher, in order to prevent his work from deteriorating into futile scholasticism, needs to pay close attention to the development of science so that he can decide what possible frameworks might be worth exploring. Thus, Carnap sees the principle of tolerance as the key to his revolutionary aim in philosophy, to abandon the metaphysical aspiration to limn the true and ultimate structure of reality, and transform philosophy into a technical investigation of various syntactical calculi, or, after his acceptance of Tarski's treatment of truth, semantical systems. Okay. Now, how does this hang together with Carnapian explication? Well, according to Carnap, colloquial language, everyday language or colloquial science even, is logically messy, right? And explication is a matter of finding a remedy for this messiness, okay? And according to Carnap, that is crucial to the dissolution of traditional philosophical disputes. Okay. So there is a kind of Carnap's principle of tolerance involves a criticism of a sort of traditional picture, but it also inherits a certain feature, important feature, from the traditional picture of how logical law and order is related to the messiness of ordinary language, so to speak. So according to a traditional view, logical law and order is a prerequisite for the full-fledgedly cognitive status of science, okay, and thought. Okay. But such law and order is not present at the surface of actual language use or actual science. Okay. So there is a conflict between a sort of demand for logical law and order and the actual use of language. And now, as long as one is convinced that, as long as one is not a logical pluralist, but is convinced that there is only one compulsory logical framework, so to speak, it will seem possible to think of the relation between ordinary language or colloquial language in science and this, you know, ideal of logical order. Along the following lines, what you have on the surface is this colloquial mess. And the task of the philosopher is, by means of, let's call it, analysis or clarification, expose an underlying logical order. And even if the requirement of logical order, that's a requirement for genuine science, so to speak, even if science looks like this on the surface, the logical order will be to be found underneath, so to speak. So the task will be to reveal this logical order, which is there all the time, and in virtue of which this seemingly messy activity is in fact a genuinely cognitive activity. Now, Carnap retains the idea that for an activity to be properly cognitive, for terms like truth and inference, justification and so forth, to have really strict application, this activity or this a language or an activity must have logical law and orders. It can't be, so it'd be as messy as language and science is on the surface. On the other hand, Quine does not retain this. Carnap is a logical pluralist, so he can't really hold on to this picture anymore. Okay, because he realizes that this mess is in fact compatible with a variety of formally well-behaved systems. Right? So this picture doesn't fit. Carnap takes himself to be forced to abandon this sort of picture. So instead, what you have in Carnap is more a picture of this sort, where you have the messy colloquial language, and then you have a lot of alternative possibilities, alternative logical frameworks. That are all compatible with language use, as we see it here. Okay. Now, what Carnap is arguing is that when we describe this message, what we can do here is to, so to speak, impose logical rigor from without. Okay. We can coordinate this
colloquial language, colloquial practice, with various logical frameworks. And it's only in relation to the coordination of the language use with some such framework that we can really apply notions like truth, justification, and so forth in a properly strict fashion. Right? So if you look at quotation 6, which is from Thomas Ricketts, I think my reading of Carnap is influenced by Ricketts. So here's Ricketts. Linguistic behavior is, so to speak, in itself logically amorphous. We bring logic to it by coordinating a calculus with it. The scientific philosopher, the logician of science, describes various calculi. She can then freely pick any of these calculi and envision her group to speak a language coordinated with it. Application of terms like true, false, consequence, and consistent in the logic of science becomes tolerably precise only with such coordination, and their application is restricted to the sentences of a possible language in coordination with the calculus for which they are defined. And one can notice here then the difference in Carnap's attitude in comparison to the attitude of later Wittgenstein or Strawson or Austin and so forth, who would rather question the idea that an activity can be proper, strictly cognitive only if seen as, you know, as having the sort of formal precision characteristic of a logical symbolism. Okay. They would say, I guess very roughly, that this is an overly formalistic sort of conception of what human cognition involves. Okay. Okay, so one might say that for the traditional, non-pluralist philosopher, the messiness of colloquial practice is a mere surface phenomenon. At the deeper level of thought, say, logical law and order reigns, and this is the order which a properly constructed symbolism is designed to articulate. But for Carnap, there is no such deeper level of stable and well-determined thoughts. The messy surface is all there is to colloquial language use as such. So in offering a re-articulation in logical symbolism, what we do is not to lay bare some deeper level of genuine and determinate content. Rather, we impose rigor from without. And this is something we can do in various ways, using various systems. The correspondence between colloquial language and the imposed system is always loose enough to allow for a multitude of different alternatives. Now, according to Carnap, fitting colloquial practice into such a system of logical symbolism is a prerequisite for making distinctions that he sees as crucial to clarity on epistemological matters, such as the distinction between logical linguistic framework and assertion made within such a framework, the distinction between analytic and synthetic sentences, the distinction between formal science and factual science, and so on. Indeed, Carnap thinks adopting a viewpoint from which these distinctions can be securely made means adopting a viewpoint at which no substantive epistemological worries arise. Mathematics falls readily into place as analytic. The principles constitutive of the logico-linguistic framework wear their identity as mere constitutive principles rather than metaphysical theses on their sleeves. And there is no temptation to think of synthetic statements as justified or falsified otherwise than by observation. So, a demand for formally precise explications of concepts such as truth, consequence, and justification is thus built into Carnap's principle of tolerance. And this demand is not to the effect that there is just one true substitute or explicatum available for each such concept. On the contrary, tolerance means that many different substitutes, many different explicata can be invented, none of which is truer than another. What cannot be tolerated, if the principle is going to do its philosophical work, is formal inexactness. So as long as the proposed explicatum belongs to some precise calculus or semantic system and also fulfills certain other requirements, Carnap mentions similarity with the explicandum, scientific fruitfulness and simplicity, there is nothing philosophically inadequate about it. Okay. So here we have one conceptual explication then for Carnap, and I think a very important one. okay, what I call far, very far-reaching explication. So you take a messy colloquial language and you fit it into a coordinate it with a precise logical framework. You know? And when you do that, you can distinguish between the framework principles and the assertions made within the framework. You can distinguish between analytic and synthetic sentences. I mean, for Carnap, you can't distinguish between analytic and synthetic sentences in ordinary language. To the extent that one wants to criticize Carnap's distinction between analytic and synthetic sentences by using ordinary language examples, one is misguided, I think. I mean, he's very clear that the analytic-synthetic distinction has application only in relation to a precise framework of logical symbolism. But for Carnap, these distinctions, like the analytic-synthetic distinction between framework and assertion and so forth, are absolutely crucial to the solution of the most stubborn philosophical difficulties and disputes. Okay? Because, I mean, those distinctions are precisely the tools that he's going to apply in order to, you know, dissolve the conflict between idealism and realism, for example, behaviorism and mentalism, and so forth. He's going to say that what they do is only to propose alternative frameworks, so to speak. So in order to solve the really hard philosophical problems, Carnap requires, I think, this very far-reaching sort of explication. Now, one thing that is confusing in Carnap is that when he talks about explication, he often discusses examples other than these, much more limited explications, like the replacement of warm and cold with the notion of temperature, for example, or the replacement of the ordinary concept of fish with the corresponding scientific concept and so forth. And those explications seem to be much more limited than this one. Okay. Also, when he's discussing with people like Strawson, and these are very interesting discussions, he's very careful to say that he doesn't object to more like non-revisionist procedures or, you know, ordinary language procedures. He says that, you know, maybe there is no conflict between our different approaches. You know, my approach may be useful for some problems, your approach may be useful for other problems. Okay. But in fact, I think you don't have to scratch that much on the surface to see that Carnap thinks that procedures like Strawson, which are not revisionist at all, or limited forms of revisionisms that don't introduce this sort of logical symbolism in this far-reaching kind of way, they can only deal with relatively superficial problems. Okay. So, like in quotation 9, which is from his reply to Strawson, in my view, the extent to which artificial and elaborate means are used depends on the nature of the philosophical problem in question and also on the aim of the therapy. The aim may merely be to eliminate an isolated minor difficulty in the simplest way possible, an isolated minor difficulty. In this case, simple means will suffice. Or the aim may be a more through-going reform in order to overcome a larger group of interconnected philosophical difficulties. In this case, it may be necessary to use more elaborate means and a more comprehensive systematization. Okay. So I think, even if Carnap sometimes seems to have a pretty relaxed attitude towards what kind of revision, how far-reaching the revisionism is required in order to deal with philosophical problems, in fact, I think he has a very demanding standard. I mean, he really thinks that if you want to treat the really important and central philosophical problems, very far-reaching logical formalization and so forth is required. I think that's clear. Okay, over to Quine. Now, Quine, of course, rejects the principle of tolerance, and he also rejects the connected ideas that distinctions such as that between the analytic and synthetic, or between framework and assertion, and so forth, can have an important philosophical job to do, or can be epistemically of deep relevance. Okay. And one interesting way in which the difference between Quine and Carnap comes out here is
in their attitudes towards truth, the notion of truth. Whereas, as I said, Carnap thinks we can talk about truth in a properly strict fashion only in relation to a properly formalized system of logical symbolism. Quine thinks truth is just a disquotational device, so it can be applied to any. I mean, it doesn't matter how the it can be, truth can be applied to any sentence, right? So as you see on quotation 10, the important thing is that when you talk about sentences as true, you occupy your own theory, so to speak. So he says, it's only when we turn back into the midst of an actually present theory, at least hypothetically accepted, that we can and do speak sensibly of this and that sentence as true. Where it makes sense to apply true is to a sentence couched in the terms of a given theory and seen from within the theory, complete with its posited reality. Here there is no occasion to invoke even so much as the imaginary codification of scientific method. I mean, this is directly against Carnap. To say that the statement Brutus killed Caesar is true, or that the atomic weight of sodium is 23 is true, is in effect simply to say that Brutus killed Caesar, or that the atomic weight of sodium is 23. Now, so already here we can see, I mean, we can see how Aquine's deflation of this, I mean, the epistemic relevance of this sort of move here, that Carnap, the epistemic and philosophical relevance, the wider philosophical relevance, how this is tied to very central elements in other parts of Quine's philosophy. Now, it's true that Quine thinks the notion of logical truth and associated notions of validity and consequence and so forth have clearest application in relation to sentences and arguments couched in formally well-behaved notation. So according to Quine, a formally well-behaved sentence is a logical truth if all sentences that can be generated from it by varying its non-logical vocabulary are true. Still, this account does not invoke any other notion of truth than the colloquial, disquotational one. And it involves no attempt to explain why a logical truth doesn't turn false through substitution of the envisaged sort. Thus, the fact that the account is designed to work for sentences couched in formally well-behaved notation might make it look as if Quine is similar to Carnap. But in fact, it in no way suggests that the function of such a formally well-behaved notation is to provide us with a secure basis for making epistemically potent distinctions of the sort Carnap is imagining. For Quine, logical truths have no special epistemic status. They are just obvious, or can be resolved into obvious steps, in a behaviorist sense of the word. Speakers assent to them without hesitation, but that's true also of, for example, it's raining when it's uttered in the rain. So Quine says of the interconnections between the sentences of a theory, and this is quotation 12, there are so-called logical connections, and there are so-called causal ones, but any such interconnections of sentences must finally be due to the conditioning of sentences as responses to sentences as stimuli. If some of the connections count more particularly as logical or causal, they do so only by reference to so-called logical or causal laws, which in turn are sentences within the theory. The theory as a whole, a chapter of chemistry in this case, plus relevant adjuncts from logic and elsewhere, is a fabric of sentences variously associated to one another and to nonverbal stimuli by the mechanism of conditioned response. Now, it's interesting, Carnap also sometimes gives behaviorist descriptions of colloquial practice. And he says such descriptions are appropriate if the aim is to capture the mere facts of such a practice without imposing upon it the rules of a calculus or a semantic system. But the difference is that Quine doesn't see the paraphrasing of colloquial sentences into logical symbolism as a matter of such imposition from without. Rather, he conceives of logical symbolism as already part of colloquial language, and of formally well-defined inferential connections as no less a matter of associations entrenched in behavior than other patterns of use. According to Quine, clearing up colloquial usage by means of logical symbolism is therefore no different in principle from more commonplace modes of clarification. Quote, to paraphrase a sentence of ordinary language into logical symbols is virtually to paraphrase it into a special part still of ordinary or semi-ordinary language. Paraphrasing into logical symbols is, after all, not unlike what we all do every day in paraphrasing sentences to avoid ambiguity. So, I mean, Quine is all, I mean, it's all the time resisting this kind of picture where you have on the one hand this messy colloquial language given, I mean, as a fact, and then the coordination seen as another form of activity done by the philosopher and the logician of science. I mean, for Quine, the clarification of this messy colloquial language is a matter of gradually developing it into a less messy form of colloquial language. Now, it's true that Quine believes the paraphrasing of sentences of colloquial language into logical symbolism is important for philosophical purposes. And he talks in this connection about regimentation, okay? So the paraphrasing for Quine of colloquial language into logical symbolism is what he calls regimentation. Okay. But for him, I mean, Quinean regimentation is quite different from Carnap's in that he's working with one... He thinks of it simply as part of the project of getting clear about what the world is like. So regimentation is a matter of getting clear about, you know, one's ontological commitments. And in order to do that, there is one canonical notation that is the relevant one here, namely first-order predicate logic with identity. So the picture becomes quite different from Carnap's picture. Okay. So far I've been talking about how Quine conceives of the paraphrasing of colloquial language into the language of first-order predicate logic, okay? But I've also said that that is a matter of Quine regimentation. It isn't really a matter of Quine explication, at least it's not a paradigmatic case of it, right? There are questions about, I mean, whether some forms of Quine regimentation are matters of explication, but we can maybe return to that in discussion. Now I want to look at what Quine himself says about explication and his favorite example of explication. And that's Quine's ordered pair example. So I thought I'm going to talk about that a little and then we can go on to discussion. So the ordered pair example for Quine uses that as a paradigm example of philosophical clarification or philosophical explication. Okay? And the ordered pair, he says, was introduced by mathematicians as subject to one specific postulate, he says. Okay? And that's simply the following postulate, which sort of defines the kind of work that the ordered pair does within mathematics. So this sort of explains in what sense an ordered pair is ordered. Okay, so if the ordered pair x, y is identical with the ordered pair zw, then x is identical with z and y is identical with w. Okay. And now Quine brings up two ways of defining ordered pairs in terms of set theory. And one way is that of Norbert Wiener. According to which the ordered pair xy is identical with the set of the set of x and the set of y and the empty set. And then there is an alternative, more famous. Definition, according to Kuratowski. According to which the ordered pair xy is identical with the set of the set of x and the set of x and y. And now both these definitions fulfill this postulate, right? Okay. So if you identify the ordered pair with this one, then and this ordered pair with the corresponding set, then it will be true that this holds. And the same for Kuratowski's explication. So both explications here take care of this postulate, and according to Klein, since this postulate defines all the work done by the notion of ordered pair within mathematics, these two are equally good as explications, even if they are not, they conflict with them. You can't use them both at the same time, of course. But you can use either one. Both are equally good. So this is on quotation 17, if you have it in unscrambled form. Which is right, says Quine, all are. All fulfill the postulate one, and conflict with one another only out among the don't cares. Any error of paradox comes only of supposing that there is a unique right analysis. A mistake that is encouraged by the practice, otherwise convenient, of using the term ordered pair for each version. In the beginning, there was the notion of ordered pair, defective and perplexing, but serviceable. Then men found that whatever good had been accomplished by talking of ordered pair, the ordered pair XY, could be accomplished by talking instead of the class of X and the class of Y and the empty set, or for that matter, the class of X. And the class of x and y. Now this may sound a lot like Carnap, if you look again at quotation 18 right after. Since the datum is inexact, the problem itself not stated in exact terms, and yet we're asked to give an exact solution. This is one of the blah blah blah. If an explication is proposed, we can't decide in an exact way whether it's right or wrong. Strictly speaking, the question whether the solution is right or wrong makes no good sense because there is no clear-cut answer. The question should rather be whether the proposed solution is satisfactory. It may sound
as if this example would illustrate Carnap's conception of explication, but I don't think it's a Carnapian explication at all. I don't think it is Carnap. I don't think Carnap would count it as an explication. At least not if we're going to take him ad notam when he says that in a problem of explication, the explicandum is not given in exact terms. If it were, no explication would be necessary. Because I think it's quite arguable that the notion of ordered pair is perfectly exact already here, so to speak, already with the postulate one. I mean, I don't think what is achieved here is not a matter of increasing exactness, I think. Okay. Whereas it's true that Quine talks in those terms. He says the notion of ordered pair is unclear and so forth. It's only when we get a set theoretical substitute that we get clear about the notion. But I think, in fact, that clarity is achieved already here with this postulate and with the observation that this captures all the work that the ordered pair does within mathematics. I'm going to say a few words about this before I end, I think. What is unclear is why Quine says that the notion of ordered pair is unclear. I mean, it's true that people have been confused about it, and Quine cites Peirce as someone who is confused and gives a sort of obscurely mentalistic account of what an ordered pair is. But once you realize that this postulate one sort of captures all the work done by the notion of ordered pair, it's unclear why you would need to say anything more in order to get clear about what an ordered pair is. Right? And that is, of course, a crucial step in the explicatory process. Right? What we get here, it seems, is more like a theoretical unification. We get to see that the notion of ordered pair can be incorporated into set theory. And that's, of course, an important thing to do, especially if, like Quine, you also want something like an ontological economy. Right? So you can say after this that an ordered pair is nothing but a set. Okay, so we don't have to postulate ordered pairs in addition to sets in order to use ordered pairs within our logical theory. But look, why would the notion of ordered pair be unclear or inexact before the explication? Let's look at Quine's favorite notions of clarity. One is extensionality. Okay? So according to Quine, something has to be extensional in order to be clear. So I think it's clear that the notion of ordered pair is extensional as it stands. I mean, there's no problem about that. I mean, this postulate, we can, well, I mean, quantify over ordered pairs in extensional theory. They don't create problems for us in that respect, even before the explication. And also, another notion of clarity, or a related notion, of course, but that Quine is working with, is there should be clear criteria of identity. No entity without identity. So if we're not clear about the criteria of identity, we're not clear about the notion we're talking about. But of course, this is precisely a clear criterion of identity here. So, I mean, it's not as if we get any clearer criteria of identity when we have these set theoretical explications. So I think this, in fact, shows that Quine's notion of explication isn't a matter of getting a clearer notion or a more exact notion in Carnap's sense. It's much more about ontological economy, ontological parsimony. We can show that ordered pairs, we don't have to assume the existence of ordered pairs in addition to sets. That's what Quine really wants us to get by this kind of explication. But then it's also, I mean, given that this is so, I find it difficult to, at least with respect to this example, it's difficult to understand really what Quine means when he says that the ordered pair is unclear. But then it becomes also difficult to see if he really has a point against the kind of Wittgensteinian philosophers he's deriding in quotation 19, for example. He says, it is ironical that those philosophers most influenced by Wittgenstein are largely the ones who most deplore the explications just now enumerated. Well, he has several, except for this one. In steadfast laymanship, they deplore them as departures from ordinary language, failing to appreciate that it is precisely by showing how to circumvent the problematic parts of ordinary usage that we show the problems to be purely verbal. I guess what a Wittgenstein, the kind of philosopher he's talking about here, what such a philosopher would say is that once this step has been taken, clarity has been achieved, and this is a purely descriptive non-revisionist step, so to speak. This is a formulation of what work the notion of ordered pair does within mathematics. And that sort of is enough to get rid of any puzzlement you might have about the notion of ordered pair. Once you're clear about that this captures the work done, it would be sort of strange to still be confused about the notion of ordered pair. So, I mean, And then, of course, one should acknowledge that this is an important step in terms of theoretical unification and so forth. So it's not as if, but it's not a step that will help us get rid of philosophical puzzlement, I think, in this case. Okay. That step was already taken. Okay, I have a discussion about, I mean, maybe other examples of explication is more relevant for Quine. For example, the explication of mental states in terms of physical states. Maybe we can talk about that in discussion.
Okay.
Okay, I think I'll finish here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.